Again, these are the parshiyos of Yetzias Mitzrayim. And we know that, in effect, this was already foretold to Avraham Avinu, right? We have the thing called the Bris Ben Absarim. This is the covenant among the parts, where Avraham Avinu asked Hashem, how do I know that my descendants will inherit Eretz Yisrael? So HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, cut up animals, and the Shechina, as it were, walked between the animals together with Avraham Avinu, and that's called the Bris Ben Absarim. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to Avraham Avinu, Yedoa Teda, you shall know, you shall surely know, Ki Ger Yia Zaracha B'Eretz Lo Lahem, that your children will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, V'Avadum, and they will be Avadim, they will serve them, the host nation, V'inu Osam, and the host nation will afflict them, Arba Me'oshana, V'Gamis Hagoy Asher Yavaydu, but the nation that enslaves them, Don Anochi, I will judge, V'Acharei Chen Yetzu V'Rechush Gadol, then they will go with Rechush Gadol, they will go with great wealth. So this was already told to Avraham Avinu, that there would be a servitude, there would be a Shiva, there would be an Abdus. All of this was foretold to Avraham Avinu. Now, it seems, going back to Lech Lecha, it seems in that Pasuk that it was all a consequence of Avraham Avinu asking a certain question. So the Gemara really says, the Gemara in the Nedarim says, that there were three Averos of Avraham Avinu that may have resulted in the Gezerah of the Shibut. The first was, B'ma Eda means, how do I know? Meaning, Hashem promised Avram the land, and Avram is asking, how do I know? So there was a little bit of a chisaron emuna in asking for some proof. But that's really shver in many, many ways, because instead of looking at it as a punishment, because after all, in that very pasuk, after it says, B'ma Eda, it says, V'hem in B'Hashem, he believed in Hashem, and this was a schus. So it's very hard to say, B'ma Eda is a chisaron of emuna. In fact, if you look at Rashi, Rashi says, B'ma Eda is not a question, how do I know you'll keep your promise? Rather, he's simply saying, by what merit shall my descendants be able to keep Eretz Yisrael after they have it? And the animals is really an answer. They will be able to keep it in the merit of the Korbanos or the Avodah, the prayer that they perform. So the Gemara itself does not view B'ma Eda as a chisaron emuna. It simply is, he needs information, meaning, I know you will take them out and give them Eretz Yisrael, but what will be the zechus of their being able to keep it? Also, one might say a slightly different way, that in effect, when Avraham Avinu is asking, how will I know, what will be the basis of my children's right to Eretz Yisrael? Hashem is saying, because of their slavery. The slavery gives them this entitlement to Eretz Yisrael because they suffered and therefore they deserve Eretz Yisrael. But be it as it may, there is at least one opinion in the Gemara that says B'ma Eda is a chisaron emuna. The second interpretation the Gemara says is Osa Angaria B'Talmidei Chachamim, that when Avraham Avinu, if you remember when there was a war between the four kings, four major kings and the five smaller kings, Avram sided with the five smaller kings, but Lot, his nephew, was taken captive by the four major kings, and Avraham Avinu raised an army, and he defeated those kings, and he was able to take Lot back. So according to one interpretation, he utilized Talmidei Chachamim, students of Torah, whatever that meant, who were these big Talmidei Chachamim in Avram's time, to engage in a military operation. So that was a very big avera that has some relevance to drafting yeshiva students and the like. Also, on Garya, he drafted Talmidei Chachamim and he impressed them into military service. That's avera number two. And the third avera was the aftermath of that very war, that when Melech Saddam said to him, give me back the people that you captured and I'll give you back the spoils, right? Tein li hanefesh. So Avraham Avinu gave him back all of the, Melech Saddam, if you recall, in that war was actually on Avraham's side. It was like the United States in World War II was on Stalin's side. We were on the side of the Russians. But Avraham had reclaimed a lot of the captives of war, and by right, he had the right to keep them, but he gave back to Saddam. He repatriated to Saddam all of the people that belonged to Saddam. And he refused to take any spoils of war. So the Gemara says it was actually an Aveira on his part. He should have kept those people as slaves because he could have been machnas them under Kanfei Hashchina. So the Gemara actually identifies no fewer than three Aveiros that caused this Shibud, either the question of Ama Eda, or the question of Asa and Garia B'Tamanei Chachamim, or he turned away Nefashos that he could have brought Tachas Kanfei Hashchina.
Could that be one of the reasons why he later on pleaded so fervently for Sdom? Because he sort of saw it as a mistake on his part, but he didn't.
Well, that's a very interesting point. In other words, maybe Rav Avinu had a certain pang of guilt that they became as evil as they became because they were not under his hashpa. You never know. That's a very interesting story. You never know what a tzaddik could do. If you remember in another context, when Dina is raped by Shechem, so if you remember the story that Yaakov was very much afraid that Esav would marry Dina. So it says he put Dina in a box, whatever that probably doesn't mean literally, but he put her in a box so that Esav would not see her, Esav would not be attracted to her. So as an onesh, it says, for not making Dina available to Esav, this happened, that Dina was publicly, was raped and dishonored. So everyone asks the question, what type of taina is it? I mean, if I don't want my daughter to marry a big Russia, like, it's an onesh to me, it's an aveira on my part that I kept her away from an evil person. Like, what type of taina? What should Yaakov have done? So, some learn. Well, okay, a few things. Some learn, I think Adolf Lefty used to say, that it's okay to put Dina in a box, but you don't nail it shut. Meaning to say, the pshat is that even though Yaakov had very, very good reasons for keeping her away from Esav, but part of it was also a desire not to give his brother that pleasure. Meaning it wasn't only L'shem Shemayim, it was a certain sense of getting back at Esav in yet another way. So Yaakov is nanash for that little bit of Netiyah Shelo L'shem Shemayim. But others say that Yaakov underestimated the power of a righteous woman to turn around a righteous woman. That indeed, the metric tells us, and this is actually, of course it's true because I say it, but it's something that's absolutely true in the sense that you can see it in daily life as well, even today, and that is a righteous woman can have a much, much bigger hashpa on a man than vice versa. The metric tells us that there was a big tzaddikess who married a rasha and she made him a tzaddik. Then it says the other way around, a tzaddik married a rishas, and she made him a rasha. But in this case, either way, but you're correct. I mean, certainly if Avraham Avinu would have had the Sodomites, they could have become very, very righteous. So these are the three aveiros that the Gemara Nedarim identifies as the root of Shibud Mitzrayim. But the truth is, the Maral actually says that L'chaira, it's a little difficult, because the reason for Shibud Mitzrayim, other sources say, was it was an outgrowth of the hatred against Yosef and the Sinna, and we needed Mitzrayim to bring us together with unity and Achdus and love. So it's more connected to Mechiras Yosef than it is to Avram. And because of this, the Maral learns that when the Gemara talks about Avram's Averos, it is not talking about why we were enslaved. It's talking about why Hashem told Avraham that there would be an enslavement. Because Avraham Avinu, in some ways, was normally shielded from bad information. For example, Esav didn't become a Rasha in the lifetime of Avraham, right? The whole idea of it was only the day that Avraham died. Yishmael did Shuba. In other words, Hashem would have shielded Avraham from the bad tidings had Avraham not had these Averos. These Averos, the Maral said, were the reason why Hashem told him, but they weren't the etzem reason for the Shibud, itself. Okay, that's the chilik. That's how the Maral says with the Gemara.
So the news itself is a punishment.
Huh? The bad news is a punishment to him. Yeah. Why does he have to know this? Right. Okay. But be it as it may, this idea that the Egyptian exile was foretold, was predicted, was decreed, does of course give rise to one of the great philosophical problems. Again, you probably have come across this over the years. And that is, in the Rambam in Hilchos Tshuva, devotes a great deal of space to the principle of Bechira. Right? Bechira is probably the most often talked about topic in our Sameach, free will. I remember sometimes I walk by and I'm bombarded with signs announcing 10 different shiurim on free will. Free will and this, free will and that, free will and that. Right? So everyone talks about free will. But the Rambam in Hilchos Tshuva does say that Bechira Chafshis, free will, is one of the most fundamental principles of Judaism. And it is free will that is the logical basis for reward and punishment. If we believe Hashem rewards people when they do good things, either this world, that world, this is not important for our purposes, how and when Hashem rewards you, but ultimately there's a reward. So if there is a reward for doing good, and if there's a punishment, either in this world or the world to come, for doing evil, it can only exist if human beings have free choice. Because if I have to behave a certain way because God made me a certain way, if I have to do good things because God made me do good things, if I have to do bad things because God made me with a bad nature, then it would not be just, it would not be fair for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to punish me for what I had to do, just like you don't, although we sometimes think like, let's smash that computer because it's not working, but whatever it would be, you don't destroy a machine in anger because the machine is not working, and you don't, give the computer an extra serving of ice cream because, it worked that night, etc. So the Rambam basically says free will, as opposed, of course, to predetermination, right, which is the other doctrine, is a necessary predicate for accountability, for responsibility, for the union of Schar V'Onesh. Now, it's an interesting question. The Rambam does not count free will as one of the 13 principles of faith. In other words, in spite of the fact that the Rambam says Bechira is a fundamental article of faith, the Rambam does not count it in the Yud Gimel Ikrei Emunah. But based on what I just said, it's really not a kasha, because the Rambam does count as an ikar that Hashem rewards virtue and punishes evil. And since it would be impossible for a moral God to punish evil unless you had free will not to do the evil, so one could argue that Bechira is implicit in the Shairesh, in the ikar of Schar V'Onesh, right? So that might be why the Rambam, doesn't have to count it separately if from one of the principles you automatically see the other one. Now, that's not always such a good teretz, because there are other ikrim which one can be derived from the other, and we still mention them separately. What I was thinking of is this. The Rambam has an ikar that Moshe Rabbeinu's nevuah, what Hashem will never change, and he has an ikar that the Torah will never change. But maybe that one is not automatically from the other, because a person might believe, well, whatever Hashem told Moshe, I believe in, but, who says Hashem told Moshe every word of the Torah? In other words, that's why you need two principles, one for Moshe and one for Torah, in the sense that the Torah was, Hashem gave the Torah to Moshe. Okay. So the Rambam in Hilchos Tshuva does ask a number of very interesting questions. Some of them are philosophical questions, and some of them are textual questions connected to these parshios. The philosophical questions are the well-known questions, although they're very deep questions. The first question that the Rambam asks is the tension between free will and divine omnipotence. Omnipotence means all-powerful, that Hashem controls whatever happens in the world. If Hashem controls whatever happens in the world, meaning if nothing can happen without Hashem's will, then how can I do what I want to do if Hashem controls? So that is really the least of the questions, because yes, God controls everything, but it's Hashem's will that I have free will. In other words, so Hashem controls whether, in other words, in a sense, everything that happens is the will of God, because the will of God includes free will. So if you ask this question, if I kill somebody, or I'm Mechalel Shabbos, was it God's will that I be Mechalel Shabbos? No, God does not want me to be Mechalel Shabbos, but it is God's will that I have the free will to be Mechalel Shabbos. So therefore, in a sense, my ability to do what I did was consistent with the Ratzon HaBoreh. Okay? In other words, as it were, free will is normally described as HaKadosh Baruch Hu voluntarily tying his hands to allow for the freedom of action. It's voluntary because nothing intrinsically is machriach Hashem to withdraw his control over my activities, but bechira is the sphere where Hashem has withdrawn my his power over me, and this is a voluntary. Again, Kabbalistically, this is explained by the idea of tzimtzum. Tzimtzum is a complicated idea, but tzimtzum means contraction. The Arizal, much later, talks about the idea, a very simple question, and once again, if Hashem is everywhere, then how can I exist? How can I occupy the space that Hashem takes up? The universe, right? How can the universe occupy any space if Hashem is here? So the Ari says, well, okay, so the way creation works is Hashem withdrew into himself, creating a void, creating a hollow in which things could exist. All right, it's a big machlokas. Is that an actual symptom? Is it the appearance of a symptom? But you have to understand, on one hand, you know, God forbid, this could just sound like a very childish idea that Hashem rolled over to make room. But you have to understand the cosmic repercussion. Tzimtzum is actually the foundation of Bechira, meaning to say Hashem withdrew an aspect of himself to enable a human being to function as an autonomous unit. In fact, the idea that man is made in the image of God, the image, Tzelem Elokim, is referring to the notion that unlike Malachim, who only do what Hashem commands, and unlike animals who act through that instinct, it is only God and humans who have choice. And therefore, Bechira is a divine quality, the quality of being able to choose. So the idea of omnipotence is not a problem so much, because once again, if omnipotence means Hashem can do everything, so one of the things Hashem can do is not control. Right? Hashem can decide not to control certain things. Hashem can do everything, right? So he can do that as well. But there's another aspect, and that is the Rambam says there seems to be a contradiction between free will and omniscience. The difference is omnipotence is all powerful. So good. Hashem tied his hands. He doesn't exercise his power to stop me from doing aveiros or doing mitzvahs. But omniscience is Hashem knows the future. So the Rambam raises the question, good question. Hashem knows what I'm going to do tomorrow, and he knows what someone's going to do 10,000 years from now, 20,000 years from now, a million years from now. So how can it be said when I get up Monday morning, I have the power to daven or not to daven, if Hashem knows what I'm going to choose before I choose it? Then at the moment of my choosing, I only have one possible alternative. The alternative is already there. So how do we have free will based on that idea? That's the contradiction between future knowledge and choice. Yeah.
You say that Hashem caused himself not to know?
Well,
he caused himself not to act.
Yeah, well, No, that is discussed. You know, there's a Hashem that doesn't have that omniscience, but that's a difficult point, because omniscience seems to be kind of something that's constantly there. So the Rambam asks that question, and the Rambam gives an answer that the Ravid doesn't like. The Rambam says simply this. In a way, he doesn't answer the question, but he basically says the following. He says, you're asking a question that Hashem's knowledge contradicts the idea of free will. So you want to understand the nature of Hashem's knowledge. Now the Rambam says, Hashem is a perfect unity. Unlike a human being where there's me and there's what I know, and in a sense my knowledge and my essence are two different things. There's me and there is the knowledge that goes into my head. But with Hashem, the knowledge within Hashem and HaKadosh Baruch Hu have to be one, because Hashem is a total one. Unlike a human being that's divided. I have my arm, I have my leg, I have my mind, I have my knowledge, I have my capacity of speech. With HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it is called a perfect achdus. So therefore, since God's knowledge and God's essence are one, and it's impossible for us to understand God's essence, then we can't understand God's knowledge. We logically cannot understand God's knowledge, because God's knowledge is God's essence, unlike the case of a human being. So the Rambam's basic answer is that God's knowledge is fundamentally different than human knowledge because it is an indistinguishable unity with the Almighty, it is not possible for us to understand it. So the Ravid says on this that if he couldn't answer the question, you know, he shouldn't have asked it. He says, why are you asking questions for which you're essentially saying there's no answer? So the Ravid says something also that needs a lot of explanation. The Ravid says, the question is it an answer, or it actually raises the question to another level? The Ravid says that God's knowledge is not in the nature of actual knowledge. It's in the nature of accurate prediction. Now, an example would be the following. Let's say, you know, your mother, knows that you like vanilla ice cream more than chocolate. Okay, so when she serves ice cream, let's say, and she's serving chocolate and vanilla, she knows you're going to choose vanilla. But is she interfering with your choice? Theoretically, you could surprise her and say, I want to try chocolate. But because she knows you, she knows you're going to choose vanilla. But her knowledge is simply in the nature of accurate prediction. Now, because a human being's ability to predict is never 100%, so in a sense, her predictive acumen, whatever it might be, 70, 80, 90, 95, 98, it's not going to be 100%. But theoretically, if she was aware of every molecule in your body, every little neuron, every little synaptic movement, like the more you know about a system, the more you are capable of approaching a predictive accuracy of 100%. So the Ravid says, Hashem has predictive accuracy of 100%. So Hashem is not decreeing anything. Hashem's knowledge is simply knowing who you are. Hashem knows what you'll do. Now, of course, that gets much more complicated than ice cream, because obviously human choices are very morkav, meaning to say they're a complex. I mean, in other words, I know that on a given day you're going to do a certain avera. I mean, that even mom wouldn't know necessarily that on Monday, September, 15th, 2018. But whatever it is, the Ravid says Hashem's knowledge is predictive, and just as mom's knowledge that you like vanilla does not take away your free will to choose chocolate, so Hashem's knowledge you are a person that's going to do an avera in a certain day does not take away your free will. The problem with that argument is this. The problem with that argument is maybe the whole concept undermines free will, because if you're basically saying that if I know your whole system from the beginning to the end, I know, everything that happened to you, and I know every component of your body and mind, I can predict, then in a sense, in fact, this was the position of famous American behaviorists like John Watson, going back to the beginning of the 20th century. Watson basically denied there was free will, because he said free will is an illusion simply because we never have perfect knowledge of a person's past. As Watson argued that everything is ultimately predictable. If I knew exactly everything that happened to you from the beginning to the end, then every action you do would simply be a consequence of everything that happened. But obviously nobody knows everything that happened. Right? So, I mean, the problem is the Ravid seems to be espousing almost the same idea, that God knows what you're going to do because he knows everything up to this point. But that itself is an undermining of free will, because that suggests that every choice you make is simply an outgrowth of all the other decisions that were made in your life and all the other events in your life. But okay, but this is the Ravid.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, Watson argued that you will never have, Watson actually argued if you had two people that had exactly the same experiences and exactly the same genetic endowment, they would always behave the same way. And if you see two people that were identical twins who were raised identically, something was different. It may be a small thing. Something had to have been different. Now, B'pashtus, Bechira says exactly not that way, right? Bechira says that although we're influenced by our environment, to be sure, but nothing is deterministic in that way. So all I'm saying is that the Rebbe's argument that because Hashem knows everything that happened to us, he can predict what we will do, seems to seems to be l'havdil, almost a Watsonian approach, which instead of explaining free will, might actually create the idea that there is no such thing as free will.
Does it also go against, the fact that Hashem is high high by New Year?
Well, obviously the Rebbe is obviously redefining what it means Hashem knows the future. That's a very radical thing. Now, a third approach, which incorporates what you just said in a very good way, is that the whole kasha of knowledge versus free will is only a contradiction if you live in a time-based world, meaning when you live in a world where there's the past, the present, and the future. And from our perspective, the future hasn't happened yet. It hasn't happened yet. So then, if I know what's going to be, so by the time the future becomes the present, there is no choice to be made. And then we have the kasha. Well, if it's already known, then there's no choice. But that's only true in a world of sequential movement of time, where the past precedes the future moment. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu is above time. HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not exist. In other words, Hashem does not know the future as future. But rather, existing above time, HaKadosh Baruch Hu sees the panorama of existence in a simultaneous view. And as a result, the same way, for example, if I see you davening right now, I did not foreclose your choice. I'm just seeing the choices you made. So for Hashem, every future moment is just the equivalent of a present moment. So Hashem is the observer of choices. He does not foreclose the choice. See, in a world of time, as we perceive it, then if Hashem knows on Monday what I'm doing on Tuesday, then when Tuesday comes, there is no choice. But Hashem is not seeing Tuesday from the vantage point of Monday. Hashem is seeing Tuesday from the vantage point of Tuesday, meaning HaKadosh Baruch Hu is already in all of these dimensions. Therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is an observer of time, an observer above time. And as a result, therefore, again, by analogy, what I see you doing right now is not interfering with your choice. It's just observing your choice. Hashem observes our choices, right? So there are different mahalchim in this. These are the philosophical questions the Rambam raises. But then he raises textual questions. And the textual questions really come down to our parsha. And that is, the Rambam raises the question that HaKadosh Baruch Hu l'chayra decreed that the Egyptians would enslave the Jewish people. HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Abram, your children will be enslaved. So the question becomes, did the Egyptians have free will? How could they be accountable for enslaving the Jewish people? Did they not have free will? Did they not have free will? Now, didn't Hashem take away free will? So the Rambam's answer is the following. And Bukhari, you could make this argument whenever God decrees. In other words, how could the Egyptians be punished? In other words, in the pasuk itself, there's a contradiction. A nation that is not yours will enslave you, and I will punish that nation. Hashem is decreeing they will enslave you. How could they be punished? So the Rambam answers the following. The Rambam answers that Hashem did not decree that the Egyptians will enslave. It doesn't mention Mitzrayim in that pasuk. It just says there will be servitude by a nation. Hashem did not make the Egyptians enslave the Jewish people. Every single Egyptian had free will to do good or to do bad, and for that they could be accountable. Now, what that is basically saying is the following. That is basically saying, was the punishment of Avzis decreed in Am Yisrael? Yes. What if the Egyptians would have decided not to enslave them? They would have been enslaved by some other nation. So whatever happened to the Jewish people was decreed by the Almighty. But the agent who brought that out was acting under their own free will. That's what the Rambam says. And because of that, they are accountable and they can be nanash. because although the avdus was a gezera, but the perpetrators of the avdus were acting under their own free will. This is what the Rambam says, and this is why, let's say someone like Hitler, in one sense you could say, well, 6 million Jews wouldn't have died unless it was Hashem's decree that somehow 6 million Jews would die for whatever reason, we don't know. So Hitler was a shaliach of Hashem, Rachman al-Utzlan. Right, so what are we going to say? The Nazis were just carrying out God's will. The answer is no. Hashem may have decreed a Chorban and Am Yisrael for whatever, we don't know the reasons, but whatever the reasons. But the particular instrumentality was not God mandated. It was a form of Bechira. Now, the Ramban and the Ravid both question this because they say the following. The Rambam is only answering one part of the question, meaning the Rambam is answering where was their free will. The answer is they had free will. But even if they had free will, why should it be deemed an evil exercise of free will if it was God's desire? In other words, if it was God's desire that they be enslaved, then the Ravid says, whoever does it is doing a mitzvah. In other words, the Rambam's kasha is, if God made me enslave you, how could I be punished? And the Rambam says, God didn't make me enslave you. So that question is answered. But why is there a moral condemnation for producing a result that was decreed by Hashem to be the proper result? Okay, that question the Rambam does not answer, actually. We'll come to that. Yeah. Yeah, but this is a little different because here, Hashem didn't simply say, I desire that human beings can do what they want to do. Here Hashem said, it is my desire that the Jewish people will be enslaved and persecuted. I'm not telling the Egyptians to do it. I mean, as the Ravid puts it, oh, so who does Hashem say should do it? The people who didn't enslave them? In other words, if Hashem decreed I wanted people to be enslaved, then how can you condemn the Egyptians? But putting that aside for a moment, I just want to point out, and again, if anyone here has a physics background, I apologize because I'm sure I'm not going to be totally accurate here. But this turns out an enormously complicated matrix. Because what we're saying on one hand is, everything that happens in the world is only because God decreed it, but the individual human agents who carry it out are acting under free will. So the Chovas HaLevavos is a classic statement of this, meaning if you're embarrassed, if you're hurt, if you're damaged, etc., it is only because Hashem decreed it. And if this guy wouldn't have done it to you, it would have happened anyway. But that person is accountable because he had free will. So if a person walks into a 7-Eleven and gets shot or mugged at 2 o'clock in the morning, the mugger had bechira not to do it. But if the mugger wouldn't have done it, then the guy would have had a heart attack or the building would have collapsed. In other words, everything that happens is Hashem's decree, but the particular person who does it is acting under free will. So you see how enormously complicated it is to be HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I'm not going to say how hard it is, because for Hashem it's not hard, just part of the job, but you see the concept here, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu has, as it were, a plan for the world, which will happen one way or the other, or Hashem modifies his plan based on Zechus and everything else, but everything that happens is ultimately by Hashem's direction, although Hashem can change it at many, many points. And yet, to a large degree, Hashem's plan is carried out by trillions and trillions of individual decisions that human beings make over which Hashem does not influence. Right? So that's an amazing thing. Hashem's will is carried out by all sorts of individual units who are not necessarily subject to Hashem's will because Hashem has voluntarily allowed them to exercise free will. See? So this itself is a tremendously difficult undertaking in which Hashem has to match the mugger with the guy that's supposed to be the victim tonight. In other words, you decide I'm going to mug somebody tonight. And that's your decision. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I said, let's see, who needs to be mugged tonight? All right, Reuven, you're going to go for a walk. Walk the dog at 11 o'clock at night in New York or whatever it is. You see, it's kind of a shidduch situation. Hashem is making shidduchim between a perpetrator and victim. And it's a very complicated thing. So I just want to point out, and this is what I think is very, very fascinating, that this is a great paradox itself. And this is the Rambam doesn't really discuss. But it's a paradox that's embedded in the physical structures of the universe. Very, very fascinating point. You know, we have two basic systems of physics. We have what is called Newtonian physics, and we have what is called quantum mechanics. Now, at a very, very simple level, because that's as really as far as I can go, Newtonian physics is the physics of that science has laws, has invariable principles, whether it be gravity, the principles of light, whatever it is, and we can predict how various aspects of the universe will respond in accordance with certain phenomena. That when I release my hold on the pen, gravity, for example, will say the pen will go down instead of going up. Right? So Newton's great, brilliant genius. By the way, Newton was a phenomenal genius. You know, Newton's invented calculus and optics and the principles of gravity in a span of 18 months. And Newton's main interest in life, interestingly enough, he was a bit of a non-conventional Christian, was biblical commentary. We have many perushim of Newton on the Bible. And this is what he really liked. Science was a little bit of a sideline with him. So he really was a phenomenally brilliant person. So Newton's science is based on what you call determinism, predictability, consistency, that the world works in a certain way, and he was able to identify the fundamental consistent laws of the universe. Now, in the beginning of the 20th century, people like Einstein, Niels Bohr, you know, the famous physicists, Heisenberg, they discovered that on a subatomic level, if you go beneath the atom, these little critters, these little particles behave in all sorts of unpredictable ways, that they don't go where they're supposed to go, they don't follow Newtonian laws, there's indeterminacy. In fact, the whole concept of scientific laws are just predictions. Instead of saying there's something called gravity, all we can say is probabilistically, based on past experience, when you drop a pen, it tends to go down. But there's no particular reason why it won't go up next time. There are just probabilities. There is no such thing as scientific certainty. And so at first glance, you know, the quantum model, which had very, very strong scientific proof for it, seems to displace Newtonian physics. And basically, Newton was proven to be wrong. But that's not what a physicist will tell you. A physicist will tell you that both systems coexist at the same time. There is predictability, stability, and constancy in a deterministic universe, and there is also the notion of randomness and chaos. Well, how can that be? Is it one or the other? So they will give you a teretz, and they will say, Newtonian physics governs big things. So when I look at a table, a chair, a car, an airplane, a computer, Newton's principles work perfectly good. In fact, we only go on an airplane because of Newton. I wouldn't want to go on an airplane based on quantum mechanics because there's no particular assurance that it'll stay in the air any given second. I mean, that's true anyway, but even scientifically, you know. So the answer is, physicists will say, well, Newton's system works perfectly well for airplanes. Don't worry about it. Well, what does that even mean, though? Big things are nothing more than collections of little things. I mean, this table is a collection of atoms, which is a collection of subatomic particles that are running around. So if those little trillions of things around here are simply going around like a chicken with the head cut off, then if the individual particles are behaving in unpredictable ways, then why does the table behave in a predictable way if the table is just made up of a bunch of little particles? So what do you see? You see that the concept is the following. The concept is, without explaining the paradox, just identifying it, that even if the individual subunits are behaving in a random, chaotic way, overall they're balanced out. So if this particle is going too far this way, this particle will go a little farther this way. That pulls things back to an equilibrium. So within all of this wild and unpredictable randomness, there is ultimately an aggregate order that allows for the stability of Newtonian physics. I hope this is making some sense. Now, this is exactly how Hashgacha works in the world. Hashem has a plan. Hashem has a destiny. It's going to happen. But it happens by Hashem coordinating the billions of chickens without a head, the subatomic units, which are us, so to speak. We are like the subatomic particles in the universe. And therefore, although fundamentally it's a paradox, but it's a paradox that is embedded in the very physical structure of the universe. So think about Chazal's maamar. Hashem looked in the Torah and he created the world, meaning to say the world itself, the universe, not just the world, the universe is a reflection of the divinity of the Torah. And therefore, the paradox of free will and determinism is exactly the paradox of quantum mechanics and Newtonian physics. Okay? So forgive my physics, it's a very, very fascinating world. And that is why you'll actually find, I'm not going to say every physicist is religious. That's obviously not true. Stephen Hawking is a famous atheist. But many, many physicists, as a result of these types of insights, do have a very deep religious belief. Einstein is an outstanding example. Einstein was not from in any conventional sense. He was not. Although it's interesting. I read when he was 12 years old, he came from a very assimilated German family. They were not, they weren't even Reformed Jews. They just weren't anything. But when he was around 11 or 12, he was becoming a Balshuva of sorts. It's interesting. He actually explored Judaism. Part of it was he was rebellious. He had a rebellious nature, so so he would do whatever was not the mainstream. But whatever it is, it lasted for around a year and a half, and then he left it. So he never went back to observance of mitzvahs, but he was very deeply convinced that the great order of the universe and the suggested a creator, a supreme intelligence. So in that sense, he very much did believe in a God that created. He did not believe that this was a product of chaos and randomness. But he saw in all of these a divine structure of great beauty. So, and David HaMelech says, you look at nature and you appreciate Hashem. But so the truth is, the deeper you penetrate into science, the more you appreciate Hashem. And when you hear a modern physicist talking, it sounds like he's a Mokobel. They talk about string theory. Instead of three dimensions of matter, there are 26 dimensions of matter. What does that even mean? These are different. Of course, 26, interesting enough, is Yud Kei Vav Kei, the Shem HaMeforesh, and 10 dimensions of matter, the 10 spheros. I mean, they really talk, it's very Kabbalistic, and they can't even explain it in rational terms. And you ask a physicist, what does 10 dimensions of matter mean? They say, I don't know. What does it look like? We can't envision it. We don't know what it means. What is 10 dimensions? We know what 3 dimensions are. Right? 4 dimensions, time, okay? We don't even know visually what that means, but they have mathematic equations that things exist. Everything is the world of mathematics. I knew a physicist in Chicago who was a Talmud Chacham. He's not alive anymore. He was a Sephardic, so he had a connection to Kabbalah, so a little bit. So when he used to visit Eretz Yisrael, he would go to the Mekubalim, the Yeshivas HaMekubalim in Geula. Beis El, Yeshiva HaMekubalim. Most of the day they actually learn Gemara, but they spend time learning Kabbalah every day. There are yeshivas that actually learn Kabbalah in an organized way. So they would ask him when he'd come in, the old Mekubalim would ask him, so what are you doing in physics now? So he would talk about his research was in crystal formation. So he was describing the formation of crystals, so they would look at him and say, that's where you're up to. Okay, good. They had already, somehow been involved in that in some level. So that's a fascinating idea. Now, let me point out the following, though. This idea is really based on the Chovas HaLevavos. It's the Chovas HaLevavos that says, everything that happens to you is decreed by God. And it would happen with or without that human actor. But that human actor has free will, so that's why he's accountable. So according to the Chavos HaLevavos, when Reuven kills Shimon, we have to believe Hashem decreed that Shimon would die. Right? If Reuven robbed Shimon, Hashem decreed that Shimon would be robbed. And if Reuven didn't do it by the exercise of his Bechira, it would have happened anyway. That's the Chavos HaLevavos' idea, that everything is a product of Hashgacha. But I do want to point out, and I think we talked about this a few weeks ago, that the Or HaChaim HaKadosh does differ with this. The Or HaChaim HaKadosh says that Bechira is much more potent than the Chovos HaLevavos realizes. And Bechira does not only mean Reuven can decide whether to kill or not to kill, but it means if Reuven decides to kill, Reuven can kill somebody that Hashem did not decree should die. In other words, I could be destroyed by the fallout of somebody else's Bechira, which means Bechira can override Hashgacha. That's the Or HaChaim's pshat. And of course, in a sense, that's a partial answer for why bad things happen to good people, because people ask the question, why do good people suffer? Like the Chovos HaLevavos, it's a difficult question, because nobody suffers unless God decreed that they suffer. The question is why, and then we discuss different reasons, you know, whatever it is. But like the Or HaChaim, I'm not sure if this helps you or not, but at least theologically, you do have an answer, and that is, in many cases of suffering, it's suffering coming, even the Holocaust, it's suffering coming from human action. So when the suffering comes from human action, it is not Hashem that is causing the suffering. It is Hashem letting human beings wreak havoc on the lives of other humans. Now, why does Hashem allow that to happen? That's another thing, but the Or HaChaim says, if you assume Hashem wants a world of Bechira, because Bechira promotes the ultimate good, then this is the fallout. Evil is a necessary evil of Bechira. In many ways, you know, something like a tsunami may pose a more difficult problem than the Holocaust. Now, the Holocaust is, of course, such a tragedy, but the Holocaust is the paradigm of man-made evil. And according to the Or HaChaim, man-made evil doesn't pose such a problem. I mean, it's a problem. Of course it's a problem, but I mean, it doesn't pose a philosophical problem of why did God allow it to happen? As they say, don't ask where was God at Auschwitz, say where was man at Auschwitz? What did man do, you see? Now, like the Chovos HaLevavos, Zalo Maspik, like the Chovos HaLevavos, you still have this problem. Why did Hashem decree? I'm not going to answer that problem, obviously. Maybe we'll talk about it some other time. I mean, ultimately we have no answer. Moshe Rabbeinu didn't have an answer. I mean, Moshe Rabbeinu asked Hashem, why do righteous people suffer? And Hashem said, that's beyond the ability of a human being to understand. But all I'm saying is, like the Or HaChaim, you really have a very, very different approach to this, in which suffering inflicted by human beings is human action. It is not divine action, except in the passive sense that Hashem allows human beings to wreak havoc with their koach of the chira. Okay? But let me point out the following. The machlokas, okay, let me take this back. The machlokas between the Chovos HaLevavos and the Or HaChaim is not relevant in Mitzrayim, because in Mitzrayim you clearly have to go with the Chovos HaLevavos, because even if it's true Hashem didn't decree that Reuven gets killed by the mugger, Hashem did decree. Right? See, in other words, here you have to learn the Chovos HaLevavos. Hashem did decree the Jews would be enslaved. So even the Or HaChaim would have to subscribe to the idea that the accountability of the Egyptians lies in the fact that even when the result is predetermined, the process and the offenders are not predetermined. And for that, they could be held accountable, right? So whether you apply that lumdus to other events which don't have a clear gezeira is the machlokas. But when there's a clear gezeira, you have to apply the Chovos HaLevavos' approach. But that still leaves us with a question. I guess we'll hold it over next week as well, because we're all in the sugya of Yetzias Mitzrayim. That is, okay, so the Egyptians had free will. But nevertheless, if the result they were producing was the Ratzon Hashem, then why should they be punished for producing a result that was clearly the Ratzon Hashem, right? That's another question. That's the question the Ramban and the Ravid ask of the Rambam. But let me point out, that wasn't the Rambam's question. The Rambam's a different question. The Rambam's question is, where was the free will? And the Rambam answered that. the Ravid and the Ramban ask, okay, maybe you've answered where was the free will, but you still haven't answered the moral blameworthiness of making a choice that is carrying out the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay? Okay, we'll stop here and have a good day. Yes,
question.
Yeah.
So, obviously, according to all these opinions, it seems that the Bechira is the realm of human beings, not just Jews.
Well, the Rambam clearly is assuming that from this question. We'll have to discuss also Hashem hardened Parashat. That's another question of Bechira. Yeah, that's correct. There are sources that say Bechira is only for Jews and not for non-Jews. On the other hand, the Rambam, I think, rejects them. In fact, as a general rule, you will actually see in the Rambam that he doesn't, unlike Hasidus, unlike Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, which was earlier, he does not make a lot of fundamental distinctions between Jews and non-Jews. He tends to address things in terms of human versus non-human. Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, the Kuzari, makes always distinctions between the Jewish soul and the non-Jewish soul. The Rambam actually does not make those distinctions. The Rambam talks about the virtue of the Jewish people, but he does not talk about a fundamental difference in the nature of their soul. So Hasidus, that's why Hasidus very much was attracted to the Kuzari, because Hasidus, the Kuzari was earlier than the Rambam, but the Rambam actually didn't like the Kuzari's approach generally. He never mentions it.
Just a quick question on the Rav's understanding with accurate prediction,
yeah,
as the mention of Bechira. Does that lend itself to a situation whereby you could have like a sort of a multi-dimensional array of options?
Well, the question is, you know, but does Hashem know the final choice? I mean, that's going to be the question, right? Right. I mean, in theory, now, certainly, God's own plan has many options. In other words, God has contingency plans. In other words, if you choose X, it's like they have now novels they do on the internet where you can choose your, you know, you can choose different options. They were for every chapter, you can choose this and that, and then there'll be a whole different storyline for the novel. So certainly, Hashem has all of that, just like, you know, Mahatma, the Pentagon. I'm sure the Mossad here, they have contingency plans for every possible, what if, you know, Saudi Arabia invades Turkey, like, you know, what's going to be our military strategy? They have like a plan for everything. And the problem is Hashem like kind of knows which plan, but